Ladies and gentlemen, start your engines. It's time to get revved up for sports, sports, and guess what? More sports on the RPM Roundtable Podcast with Robin Clark, Paul McGaughey, and Mike Sesney.
This is the RPM Roundtable Podcast on April 11th. I'm here along with Robin and Mike. We're in the studios at Centennial College in Toronto, and this program is broadcast on Centennial Internet Radio. Let's take a look around MLB. We're through the first week and a half or so of the season. I want to start by looking at the National League East. The Mets are 5-4 in third place. They're very excited by their start, and yesterday there were rumblings that they might want to acquire Giancarlo Stanton from the Miami Marlins. Guys, what do you think of that?
I just think it's funny that the team that decided to mortgage all their good players now wants to go ahead and potentially mortgage their future for bringing back a superstar, given that they've started 5-4, and I don't know if they've taken a look at the top of the division yet or not, but Atlanta's up there at 8-1 already. So I think it's hopeless optimism, maybe, or I don't know. Good for them, I guess. Good for the Mets fans. It gives them something to be happy about. Obviously, a long time coming for them if they ever put a winning team on the field. I don't know. I think obviously Stanton's not very happy in Miami. I don't know how much more happy he would be in with the Mets, but they're a team on the rise, obviously, and I guess you can probably draw some similarities between the Mets and Miami, but I think the Mets are a bit further ahead of a rebuild than the Marlins are.
So in a sense, this might be a free Giancarlo Stanton sort of campaign.
It could be, actually, potentially.
Yeah, let's get the hashtag out there.
And I heard as well, Carlos Gonzalez, his name, mentioned as well as Giancarlo Stanton's as a potential guy to bring in for their outfield, which is pretty crappy.
But I thought the Rockies were feeling good at 5-1, and they had a real shot at the division, and they just got their asses kicked by the Giants. I think they lost 10-0 yesterday, so it's pretty funny early in the season how teams can go from challenging for the division to, oh my God, you know, we're 500 now. So it's pretty comical.
Let's take a more serious look at the Atlanta Braves. Robin, during our preview segments, you called Justin Upton as a potential MVP candidate this season. He's looking really good so far.
Yeah, definitely. As you mentioned, he went 0-for-4 yesterday, so he dropped his batting average to .353, and his on-base percentage is now under .400, so big-time slump. No, all kidding aside, yeah, Upton's got off to a great start. The Braves are rolling, and they've put up a lot of runs, mostly without Freddie Freeman, who got injured about a week ago, and they haven't had Brian McCann all season. And on top of that, one of the other new acquisitions, BJ Upton from Tampa, is only 3-for-29. So this team's going to put up a ton of runs. They're pitching really well. And I'm really looking forward to seeing their series this weekend in Washington against the Nationals. As I think we all agreed on, those two teams would be fighting it out for the NL East title all season. So should be fun.
Yeah, the guy actually who I'm pretty impressed with so far this year for the Braves is Paul Mahalom. He's pitched in two games so far, and he hasn't given up a run. He's pitched 12 and two-thirds of an inning. And he's got 13 strikeouts already, which I know he wasn't really well-known for being a strikeout guy, but so far to start this season, I mean, he's on a 200-strikeout pace, if that keeps up. But no, it's good to see him actually pitching well after coming over from the Pirates, or the Cubs, rather, actually. But yeah, playing on a winning team finally, and he's been kind of a journeyman for 9 years, I guess, and it's just nice to see him pitching well on a contender finally.
So I want to take a quick look at the Philadelphia Phillies, specifically Roy Halladay, who's off to an 0-2 start. there's been some talk already that he's on the decline at 35 years old. Is that a fair statement at this point?
I think it is. As you mentioned, Halliday has looked terrible this season, and he was just as bad in the spring. He's started two games. He's only pitched 7 1/3 innings, given up 12 earned runs, 3 home runs, walked 6, which, I mean, he didn't have anywhere close to a walk an inning in his whole career, and age catches up to you. And he's lost his velocity, and it's going to be tough. I don't know if he can turn it around. I mean, you can't write a guy off after two starts, because pretty much everyone in baseball, I'm sure, will have two starts that look like this, but you don't just get your velocity back overnight. So it's tough to see, because Halliday's been a great pitcher for over a decade and the best Jay that I've ever seen pitch. So it's tough to see.
Yeah, for me, definitely the walks stand out, having 6 walks already and 7 1/3. Just in comparison, in 2011, when he pitched 233 innings, he had 35 walks that year overall the entire season. So obviously not a guy that walks a lot of people. And the home runs also stick out to me. 3 already this year in the 7 innings he's pitched. And in 2011, he had 10 the entire season. So definitely not looking good for Halliday. I know it's only been 2 starts, but I think, like Robin said, the velocity is coming down. I don't know how much he's got left in the arm, but I'd like, you want to see a guy like him come back and pitch well, because he's just such a like amazing pitcher in our generation, for sure. Probably the best we've got to experience watching, so...
Now, I think there might be 2 factors kind of in his favor as far as turning things around. Number one, everyone knows his work ethic, right? He's first guy at the ballpark, last guy to leave. And second of all, he did get sick during spring training and I think lost 10 or 15 pounds and may still be working his way back from that illness. Do you guys see any merit to that?
I think it's definitely a possibility. I kind of remember that story, but I don't know. But people seem to think that once you get to a certain age, you can't turn it around. There's a few guys who have been able to basically adapt when they lose their velocity when they're older and sort of reinvent themselves. But I don't see it happening. I really don't. Like Mike was saying, the walks are the most telling thing to me. He had... Back when he made a few starts, he had 79 walks in 149 innings, which isn't good, but that wasn't even a full season. And his next highest walk total, he was in 2002 when he led the league in innings pitched at 239, and he had 62 walks. So it's awful to see, and they're really going to need him, because Cliff Lee isn't getting any younger, and I think that contract that the Phillies handed out to Cole Hamels to basically make him their ace was a little ridiculous.
Yeah, I remember that when they had about, what was it, 3 pitchers on their staff were making up the majority of their payroll. It was kind of, I remember when that all went down, and that was really crazy. That was kind of new for teams in the MLB, and that was kind of a surprise. But now you see where it's kind of affecting them negatively, because now they don't have very good starting pitching all of a sudden, and all this money tied up in these guys. So, and the same thing, actually, just to mention a guy who's losing velocity is Jared Weaver in Los Angeles. He's another guy now. He's on the DL all of a sudden, and you wonder if there was an injury there playing an effect into the loss of velocity.
Well, that's one of the strangest injuries I've ever seen, at least the way it was first reported. They said that Weaver had a broken elbow, like his left elbow was broken. He's a right-handed pitcher, and they said that it occurred when he was trying to get out of the way of a comebacker. And so I don't know if he twisted it. I don't know if they're faking the injury in case he has Tommy John or something. I'm not sure, but that's one of the weirdest things that I've ever seen, kind of like... the Habs this year, when they said Rene Bork had the flu, and it turns out that he had a concussion. So I'm not sure if there's some misinformation going on there, but we'll have to see with Weaver because he's been one of the best pitchers the past few years, and a lot of people, well, they were, the Angels were counting on him, right? Everyone said that they didn't have a lot of pitching outside of Weaver, so.
In the American League, the Oakland Athletics are off to a good start. They've won 7 in a row. They're now 7-2. From what I've seen from them, it's a combination of power and manufacturing runs, good pitching. They seem to be doing it all right now. Mike, what do you think?
Yeah, I watched the game last night, actually, and the one thing that stuck out to me right away was the first inning of the game. Coco Crisp led off with a single, stole second base. We know he's one of the best base stealers in the league. And then by flyout, he moves to third base. And then ground out RBI to drive him in. And I just think that run producing the scrappy mentality of that team and just how it doesn't matter. They lost, they've lost Josh Reddick for a bit of a period of time now. And just their whole team isn't really made up of any guys that really stand out to you. If I told you the name Josh Donaldson, you probably would never even have heard of him. And he's their starting third baseman. And their DH is Seth Smith, who is also a guy probably nobody's ever heard of, but he's able to drive in runs for them. And the whole team, like top to bottom, they all hit behind each other and they all want to drive the guy in who's on base. That's just the way they go. And they all celebrate every fly out, every sacrifice fly, every ground out RBI, everything, every little scrappy play that you need to win baseball games. I mean, last night they beat the Angels 11-5, and the majority of the runs were all scored by plays like that. And same with, and as well, they have guys that come in and they're able to put up big numbers too. Brandon Moss had a home run yesterday. I believe he had 5 RBIs. And it's just guys that come out of nowhere and they're all discarded elsewhere. And for some reason, these guys can put together pretty good seasons.
And you just mentioned Josh Reddick, and I see a press release here from the A's saying that he took batting practice yesterday pain-free and could actually play today. So,
oh, there you go.
Better news even.
Yeah, and they'll want him back right away. Cespedes actually has been struggling a bit as of late, but he hasn't been producing very much in the cleanup role so far this season, but I don't think it's cause for too much concern.
Given too good of a player.
Yeah, and the rest of the lineup's picking up. Jed Lowry's been a pretty big revelation for them this year. I don't think anybody saw him have his back come back around for him, and all of a sudden, he's off to a pretty good start. He's hitting over 400.
I think what really impresses me about the A's in general is that everyone knows they're the Moneyball team. A lot of listeners have probably seen the movie. The secret's out on what they do, but they continue to do it and do it well. What do you guys make of that?
I just think it's the brilliance of Billy Beane somehow. He's able to know exactly when to like let go of guys that other teams would want to hang on to. All of a sudden, he... Even with Gio Gonzalez, he's in his contract year. They let him go, and they got some really good pieces back. And they're not pieces that were really necessarily for the future. They were pieces that are already playing for them right now and helping them win. So he's definitely got an eye for talent, and I think it just can't be duplicated. It's really weird. It's like an anomaly almost. It doesn't make sense. It's kind of like one of those baseball mysteries or something.
To end off our look around the league, we're going to talk about our favorite team, the Houston Astros, who have started off 3-6. Robin, you have some observations about them.
Yeah, well, before the past couple of games, they've actually won 2 in a row. I found some stats, and I got them current as of this morning. So even in their 2 wins, Brett Wallace didn't get a hit and had one more strikeout. He is currently 1-for-21 with 17 strikeouts. And Rick Ankiel kind of ruined things. He hit a home run last night. He is 2-for-18 with 14 strikeouts. So these guys could set some kind of record. As I wrote in my blog this week, Houston will not be the worst team ever. So all the people saying that should go look up the 1899 Cleveland Spiders, who currently have the record. And, yeah, it's kind of funny seeing Houston at 3-6 and the Angels at 2-6. I wonder how many days all season we'll be able to say that. So,
when we return on the RPM Roundtable podcast, we're going to talk about the Blue Jays' 3-5 start. I think it's fair to say that fans were panicking a little bit during the Jays game yesterday when they were trailing 6-1 after five innings. They go on to put up three runs in the sixth, four in the seventh, and win 8-6 in Detroit. They're off to a 3-5 start. How do you guys feel about this team overall? It seems to me like each game has been treated almost with the importance of an NFL football game among the fans and the media. A lot of hype, a lot of coverage, just in general, just a lot of talk about the Blue Jays in Toronto right now.
Yeah, I was watching the game yesterday, and I was obviously on Twitter during the game, as I usually do, and I couldn't believe the amount of people that were jumping off of bridges at the sight of the Jays being down 4-0 in that game yesterday. And then later on, they kind of brought it within two, and then all of a sudden Detroit picked it back up, and it was 6-2. And everyone was saying, oh, this team can't hit, this team can't pitch, this team can't do anything right. And then all of a sudden, the Jays put up six runs, and they win the game. So I think people just need to relax. This team has a very talented batting lineup, and they're going to put up a lot of runs. And this team, you know, maybe they're going to have to drive in a 10-run game every once in a while until the pitching comes around. But I don't know. I just don't think this is – it's a grind, right? It's 162 games. It's not the NFL. You don't play 16. It's a whole year – or a whole summer, sorry. And just people need to relax. It's all hype and everything right now, and when people obviously don't see a hot start, it's in Toronto, the mantra is kind of to start being like, oh, we're screwed, you know, and just, I don't know, it's frustrating actually to, as a somebody who follows the team, to see people kind of get on the bandwagon and then all of a sudden things don't get off to the right, on the right foot, and everybody's just jumping off. Like, give it some time. It doesn't happen overnight, you know. Championship teams aren't built in an off season. They need time to play together. They need time to grow together. They're going to be a good team. This team's got way too much talent, in my opinion.
And speaking of championship teams, just so everyone knows and can relax a little bit, the Jays have the same number of wins right now with three that the Giants, who won last year, did after 11 games. So people can relax a little bit. And I also found it pretty funny, as Mike was saying, that yesterday seemed like this must-win game. And okay, they're 3-5. It's not great. It's not bad. But okay, so they lose yesterday and they're 2-6. So that's all of a sudden the, you know, game that ends their season with only 152 or whatever games left, 154. So I found that kind of ridiculous. The one thing I will say is that their starting pitching does need to get a little better, because they're not going to be able to come back all the time. Mark Burley got roughed up again. And in terms of all the starters, I would say he's the one who I've been most worried about.
Yeah, how much do you think factors in when in the spring – JP obviously wasn't there to work with the new pitchers during the spring. How much do you think that factors into their struggling so far?
That's an interesting point, and I'm not too sure whether that plays a role. I don't know if Burley is a slow starter like Dickey is. I don't remember ever seeing him do this badly, but 14 hits and 11 earned runs in 9 2/3 is not good. The other thing, too, with the weather and the uncertainty of when you're going to start, it might throw off your routine a little bit. So I'm willing to give him a bit of a pass yesterday, but I think it's really important that he has a good outing next time out, for sure.
And speaking of JP, I need to issue my apology to Mr. Arencibia. I know last week I was pretty hard on him, maybe he listened to the show or something and heard me talk shit about him. But
yeah,
he
probably.
He decided to start tearing the cover off the ball, and now he's hitting 313, and he's got four doubles now, and just seven RBIs, three home runs. He's now on a he's pretty hot right now. So I don't know. It was kind of funny. It was definitely me eating some crow all week from Robin for sure.
Well, wasn't, I mean, you did bring up his offense, but wasn't your concern more behind the plate?
Yeah, it was, and I still think he's going to have trouble catching Dickey. Until they work that out, I don't think he should catch him, but I'm happy to see his bat come around because he's going to be a pretty integral piece to the Jays' offense, and having him actually swinging the bat pretty well is, like, it's a plus. It's good.
Just want to highlight the season that Jose Reyes is having so far for the Jays in the leadoff spot. He has 13 hits. He's hitting .406. His on-base percentage is .472. He's stolen four bases. He's definitely doing his job at the top of the order, but he's not necessarily being, you know, brought around.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's the first time in, I don't even know how long, that they've had what you would consider to be a prototypical leadoff hitter. They experimented with different guys. Lori, I think Rasmus hit first a little bit too. So they finally have the speedy guy who gets on base. It helps that he's a switch hitter as well. And that's been really impressive. He actually stole third yesterday, I think, off former Jay Octavio Dotel. So that was really good to see. I just want to flip to the bottom of the batting order and talk about Emilio Bonifacio. I know he made his fourth error of the season yesterday. He's only hitting .230. And frankly, if you're hitting .230 and committing a ton of errors, there's no room for you in the lineup. And I know Asturias isn't doing much better, hitting .238, and he made a pretty bad error against Cleveland. But I don't think that when Lori comes back, Bonifacio is just going to have his name written in every single day, because you got to do one or the other, and right now he's doing neither.
Yeah, I think they're going to platoon Bonifacio and Asturias at second base. I could see them doing that, and maybe keeping Bonifacio on the bench in pinch-running situations. For me, I think Adam Lind still needs to do something. This is 105. He's not even hitting his own weight. And I know it's still the start of the season, but it's not very encouraging to see him struggling right now, in the especially hitting behind Encarnacion in the middle of the order. It's kind of, and yesterday you saw Mark DeRosa come in and pinch hit for him, and he actually ended up starting the rally yesterday, which was pretty pretty surprising, because you don't really expect that out of DeRosa.
No, he had three RBIs, and yeah, it was great to see. Speaking of Encarnacion, he is another guy who's struggling, but a pair of doubles yesterday off of Rick Porcello, so it was good to see him get a hit against some right-handed pitching. And yeah, hopefully that means he starts to come around.
I just wanted to ask you, Robin, too, do you have any defense for your buddy Steve Delabar from yesterday? I know those weren't his earned runs, but...
Yeah, the pair of walks were not good to see. I think he was coming in trying to throw a little hard.
Yeah.
You know, try and throw it through the guys as opposed to actually pitching. He still hasn't given up an earned run, but... yeah, I still think he's an integral part of the bullpen.
Yeah, me too. I wouldn't read too much into it either, but I know even in that situation, his career numbers are pretty good. I don't have them in front of me, but I know they put up the stat yesterday, or I read it on Twitter somewhere, and he's done very well coming in with the bases loaded with a lot of strikeouts. So it's just probably an anomaly, not too much to read into there for good old Steve Delabar.
No, I just want to get back to the late inning rally that the Jays had yesterday. How much do you think that can do for this team going into the rubber match today, if they can get the game in with the weather as it is, and then heading into the weekend series with Kansas City?
Yeah, that was actually huge. I think what the first thing actually that came to my mind was this might be something they can build off and now start to maybe get hot and play better as a team together. And maybe, you know, these guys that are in slumps like Lynn and Encarnacion might start hitting. I mean, you saw Encarnacion yesterday step it up, and you know, it's contagious, right? So maybe the maybe that rally is going to help them kind of bond and maybe put something together here.
And oh, sorry, go ahead, Robin.
Yeah, I was just going to say too, I think it's great that they got the game in, and they it'd be really good if they could get the game in today too. It says it's going to rain and be 4 degrees this afternoon, so that doesn't sound too positive, but just the way the schedule worked out this time, they missed out on facing Justin Verlander and also Max Scherzer, their number two starter. So if they could get this game in, pick up a win, and at the end of the weekend against the Kansas City in the Kansas City series be 500, I think that would be really good, and just then start to chalk up some wins, take 2 of 3, throw a sweep in there, and this bad start will be totally forgotten about.
Yeah, and you wonder how much, if today is a rain delay, it's going to kind of bog down the momentum they built yesterday there towards the end a little bit. So,
no, I will say, if they're still receiving this kind of fanfare in July, I'll be very happy. Because although it is a little bit excessive right now, it is nice to see people excited about the team.
Yeah, as long as they're not running out on the field and throwing paper airplanes, I'm okay with it.
Yeah.
The drunk fans get a little too much. There's got to be a bit of a balance there, too, I think. It's nice because it's good to see fans that aren't sitting on their hands, but at the same time, you don't want to go to a game and get a beer can thrown at the back of your head. So there's got to be, they got to find a balance somewhere, but I think it's a fun atmosphere. I kind of like when the crowd gets a little rowdy. It's entertaining to say the least, like that guy we saw there down there, the city slicker with his do-rag and bandana on and batting gloves with the double fisting a couple tall boys. He was,
that guy was having a good time.
He was pretty good stuff.
Welcome back to the RPM Roundtable Podcast. I'm Paul, I'm here with Robin and Mike. Over the next couple months, the Toronto Maple Leafs might have a chance to steal the spotlight a little bit from the Jays, as it looks like they are set to clinch a playoff spot. We don't want to jinx it, so we're not going to say it's certain, but Mike, the chances are looking pretty good.
Yeah, actually, just checking out the old Sports Club stats website again, and they're going to lose every game to not make the playoffs, and potentially, I think the worst they can do is 2-6, and they still have a 99.1% chance. I don't know where they figure in that 0.1%, but that's just according to this site and their projections and averages and however they calculate these numbers. I have no idea, but I think it's a fun website anyways. Last night's game was, I was impressed actually still. Obviously the Rangers kind of wanted that one a little bit more, and they're also fighting for a playoff spot, but I think it was encouraging to see when they got down 2-1 there, that they were able to tie it back up and pick up a point out of that game. It was a good road victory for sure to salvage a point.
Yeah, definitely. And taking 3 out of 4 points against the Rangers is a good thing. I really hope the Rangers don't make the playoffs, because I would love to see the press conference when John Tortorella gets fired. I think it would be hilarious. Have some kind of back and forth with Larry Brooks, the reporter, who he always tells, you know, to go away. And there's some pretty hilarious sound bites if any of you guys out there haven't seen it. Yeah, and I also wish that the playoffs started today to set up a 4-5 series against the Habs. I think it would be extremely entertaining, and I think the Leafs have a good chance for the whole season. People are saying, oh yeah, Montreal is miles ahead of them, and the 6-0 was just a blip on the radar and whatever, and now the Leafs are only 6 points behind the Habs and may end up, I'm not going to say catch them, because chances are they won't, but they're not that far apart as most people predicted. I also just wanted to touch on an observation made on CBC a few weeks ago, and I was just looking at some numbers. about Dion Phaneuf, who everyone loves to hate. And basically CBC was saying that when he plays 25 minutes or less, he scores more, is plus as opposed to minus, and the team's record reflects that. So in the last 12 games, he's played under 25 minutes in eight of those games. He's plus 10 and has 9 points. And so I think that adding this depth on the blue line in terms of Ryan O'Byrne, and as Mike mentioned last week, I wasn't totally fond of the trade, but I think finding guys to spread out the minutes definitely helps. I mean, you can't argue with those numbers. Anyone who says Dion Phaneuf either doesn't contribute offensively, well, as I mentioned, 9 points in 12 games is good for any defenseman, and plus 10, you know, plus one basically every game. So can't have any complaints there.
Yeah, and Ryan O'Byrne's actually an offensive juggernaut. He scored in his first game as a Leaf, so he's probably not going to score very much, but I still like that move, and I'm happy you're agreeing with that now. I just think he's going to be the shutdown guy that they wanted Holzer to be, but he just couldn't do it anymore. He couldn't keep up with the pace he started at the top of the season. And, oh, Burns been pretty good. I think JVR as well has stepped in very nicely with Lupul's injury, and he's been producing with Kessel and Bozak on the first line again, like he was there in the middle of the season when they were pretty hot line.
And speaking of Kessel, everyone seemed to say, oh yeah, he's slumping and he's having a down year. Yeah, he has 40 points in 40 games, so anyone would take that.
Yeah, and actually I found it funny on last Saturday on CBC, they were mentioning the fact that, oh, after Kadri, there's a drop-off of offense. Well, you know, look at Kessel. He's also a point-per-game player. And you know, it's like, takes 5 seconds to look at the stats, and I don't know why everybody likes to rag on him and why they always find somebody to beat up on the Leafs team for some reason that actually is playing well. Just because Kessel isn't scoring, obviously, doesn't mean he's not doing anything, and he's been great with assists this year. So,
and Kessel with 4 goals in his last 2 games, so he's catching fire at the right time.
Yeah, exactly. That's
and I think people like to get on him for the trade. First of all, the player didn't make the trade, so that's completely garbage. And second of all, people get on him, oh, because he's not, you know, a good leader and a physical player. Well, I don't want my top player going around throwing a bunch of body checks, killing penalties. You want your point-of-game player to, like, block a shot and break his foot and miss 2 months? No. So that's, I find that kind of talk totally ridiculous. I don't care if he doesn't finish a check. Go score. Let the third line guys finish their checks and do that. So I've had no complaints with Kessel, and obviously Kadri's been a really nice surprise, and JVR, people say Luke Shen is starting to play well. Well, the Flyers aren't going to make the playoffs, and you don't trade a depth defenseman for a first or second line scoring winger. So
I also actually just remembered that I've seen a lot of people getting on Randy Carlyle's case kind of for being a hard-ass coach. And I think, I know for years everyone's been kind of, oh, we need a hard-ass coach. We need a guy who's going to come in and, you know, discipline the players when they need to be disciplined. And now all of a sudden, because he's, you know, benching Jake Gardner and he's putting out Fraser McLaren and Colton Orr in meaningful minutes, people are getting all pissed off for no reason. But he's putting the results out. I mean, they're winning. Are they going to make the playoffs? Probably, yes. So I don't see what everybody's problem is with Randy Carlyle when he's giving you something that's a winning product. You know, and these players, maybe they don't deserve to play, right?
Yeah, and my sense is that the players respect him, whereas I think Ron Wilson had totally lost the room.
Yeah,
you know, Carlyle can get away with running the team that way.
Yeah, and it works, right? I mean, you've seen it. A guy gets put out and gets less minutes. The next game, he's going to play twice as hard to get those minutes back. It just makes sense. But for some reason, I've been all over Twitter. People are having this huge issue with how, oh, Jake Gardner, and I even saw an article about it the other day, and I think it was on Sportsnet, and it was about, you know, the free Jake Gardner. He hasn't really been freed yet. Well, okay, he's in the NHL, so what, he's sitting in the press box that means that there's a player playing in the game that's probably earned the minutes more than he has. And if you want him to play and jeopardize the team's chances of winning a game, then I'm sorry, but we should have Ron Wilson back then if that's the way you want it.
And like I mentioned before, with Phaneuf supplying the offense, you've also got Cody Franzen, who's had a really nice offensive season. There's two guys, and Lyles, obviously, as well. There's three offensive defensemen. Jake Gardner is not good in his own end. You don't need more offensive defensemen. They brought in O'Byrne, they've got Mark Fraser, and they've got Carl Gunnarsson. And right now, that's my top six.
Yeah.
And there's no room for Gardner. So whether he's freed up here and enjoys sitting in the press box, or he wants to go play, 30 minutes in the AHL, whatever. But he's not part of the plan for this season. And I don't think that if they don't put him in the lineup down the stretch, they're not just going to throw him in the playoffs.
No, and I read that article, and you brought it up. The whole time I was just thinking, why isn't this guy in the AHL right now getting valuable minutes?
Doesn't make sense. It really doesn't. I also wanted
to...
Well,
they can't send him down now.
Oh, that's right. He can't go through waivers. Yeah. So he doesn't really have a choice.
Yeah.
But they shouldn't have brought him up in the first place. I hope it wasn't reactionary to what his agent did.
Well, now you wonder if it was, right? Because he's here, but he's riding the pine. So,
I think it's fair to say that their playoff success isn't going to ride on what Jake Gardner does. From what I've seen of this team, they're gritty and they have the goal scoring to back it up. I think that'll translate into a good style of play in the playoffs. What do you think, Robin?
I totally agree with you. I also think that, as I was saying, hoping for the Leafs-Habs first round, I think often playoffs there's no fighting and it's a totally different game, but I think the Leafs could change that. I think it's probably their best chance to beat the Habs by playing a physical game. And in the next 2 weeks, actually, both this Saturday and the last game of the season on April 27th, they host the Habs. So that could be a preview of things to come. And even though, as we said, they're probably going to get in, I think they would do well to win at least those two games out of the final eight.
Yeah, actually, it's funny how that kind of stigma is attached to the playoffs, that there's no fighting. I wonder if we see a return of fighting in the playoffs with the Leafs team, considering that they do have the two heavyweights playing on the fourth line. And I just think it would be kind of funny, because as kind of valuable as they've been to this team, and I know people don't agree with that, but I do think they are. They have been giving the smaller forwards the opportunity to play a little bit taller. And if you don't see that, then I don't think you're watching the game, because when these guys weren't here, that was not happening. It was intimidation, and you don't see the Leafs getting intimidated by the Bruins anymore like they used to. So I think it factors in, but I think it would be great if Toronto played Montreal in the first round. It would be nice to see the Leafs go into their building and maybe rough them up a few games, and it could go the other way and Montreal could win the series. But it's playoff hockey in Toronto, and it's been coming. We've been waiting for it for years now. And if you're really worried about who they're going to play, let's just remember that they haven't played anybody in the playoffs for the last 8 years. So there's no sense getting too worked up about who they're going to play in the first round.
And that's the thing, too, just as you were mentioning, there's been no playoffs. Obviously, everyone knows they're the only team since the lockout not to make the playoffs. And it's almost strange, like, people aren't that excited, because I think that they would have a real fight on their hands. Like, either they were going to miss out on the playoffs this year or just squeak in like, seventh or eighth. And they've pretty much, people have known that they were going to be in the playoffs for the past couple of weeks. And it's strange, so I hope the city gets fired up once the playoffs start.
When we return on the RPM Roundtable podcast, we're going to talk about Carmelo Anthony. So I remember back about, it might have even been 2 months ago now, Robin, when you were saying to me that you wanted to make a case for Carmelo Anthony as the MVP of the league. And I really wish we had got that on tape, because that might be looking good on you right now. Just to recap what Melo has been doing, his last five games go like this as far as scoring: 50, 40, 41, 36, and 36. And the Knicks overall have won 13 games in a row.
Yeah, and I believe they clinched the Atlantic a couple of nights ago. And just looking at their stats, I believe Melo is leading the league in scoring at 28.6 points per game. And my whole argument for Melo over LeBron, there's a couple of components. So first of all, it looked as though they were going to battle it out for the number one seed in the East. Obviously, that didn't happen. Melo was injured. The Heat went on that great run. Okay, fair enough. But looking within their stats, people say, well, look, LeBron is more of a distributor. He puts up 7.2 points a game. And my counter to that is look at who is the so-called starting point guard for Miami. Mario Chalmers only averages 3.5 assists per game and plays, I think, 26 minutes a game this season. And so comparing that to the Knicks, who use more of a traditional point guard, Felton plays heavy minutes and distributes the ball. Jason Kidd also gets some time there. So expecting Melo to match LeBron's assist output is kind of crazy. And other than that, it's pretty even. LeBron obviously has Wade and Bosch, the big 2.5, as I like to call them. And so I think that Melo has a legit shot at the MVP. And right now, I would say, yeah, he should be.
Now, there's a stat that we can get into. It's kind of complicated. It's called win shares. It's kind of like wins above replacement in baseball, as you're familiar with.
Yep.
So if you can follow me on this one, LeBron's share is 18, okay?
Okay.
Of his team's 61 wins, right? It's really complicated, but basically for each win, there's three shares, okay? So that would be like 180 shares for the Heat. LeBron has 18 of those. Melo has, so the Knicks have 51 wins. So that's like 150 shares, of which Melo has 9. So again, really complicated, but to keep it simple, LeBron basically has twice as many win shares as Melo. Does that factor into your thoughts at all on who should be the MVP?
I mean, sort of, although as we were saying yesterday, we were talking about, as you said, war, wins above replacement, and last season in the MLB, people were saying Mike Trout over Cabrera because he had a higher war, and I think those types of stats serve a purpose, but I don't necessarily think that the purpose is to debate awards, because some people can follow it, they understand it, and I mean, I didn't know that, obviously, and certainly it should play a bit of a factor, but I just think that, as I said, advanced stats and metrics shouldn't be for debating that.
And I would be surprised if they even are, but you wonder if that's going to start to play a factor in those awards just because so much attention is being drawn to advanced statistics now. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, for sure. So are you saying even in basketball people are starting to pay attention to that kind of stuff?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Huge. We gotta go.
That's the fire alarm's going off.
Thank you for listening to the RPM Roundtable Podcast.